Okay, good evening. I'll call to order the meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement for March 31, 2009. We have a quorum on the House side. We do not have a quorum on the Senate side. I do know Senator Olson's around because I just saw her downstairs a few minutes ago. So we have a quorum. We can adopt the minutes, though, so for March 17, 2009, which was St.
Patrick's Day.
Yes, it was. It was the most exciting thing that happened to me on St. Patrick's Day.
So Representative Murphy then proudly moves adoption of the minutes for March 17, 2009. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. I mean, let's the record reflect. No, we do have a quorum, full quorum. Thank you. Just so we know what's going on tonight, we're going to make review the omnibus pension bill and then look at some technical amendments. We do have, it looks like, two issues that have come to our attention that probably need to be addressed sooner than later, so I added them to the agenda. And so let's see, Mr. Martin, could you review what we have so far in the omnibus pension bill and any corrections that you or Mr. Burke want to bring to our attention?
Members, you have document S0191-DE3. It's the thickest item in your I'm sorry, it's not DE3. Yes, it is DE3. It's the thickest item in your packets. This represents the 23 bills and two amendments that you added to the omnibus pension bill through March 20th. We've organized the bill largely along type of pension plan, generally following the statutory placement. So stuff that's earlier in Minnesota statutes tends to land earlier in the omnibus bill, and things like the volunteer fire tend to land later, and then followed up at the end with the one person and small group bills, which are not largely not coded provisions. We do have in your packets two items. One has to do with it would be the item 1A, which Mr. Burek will handle. This has to do with the erroneous contributions, both within PERA and the first class city teachers. You remember there was a problem in Duluth and some other jurisdictions where improper or inappropriate definitions of salary were used, resulting in larger contributions being made to the pension fund, PERA, police and fire, and apparently Duluth teachers for some period of time. And there is something in the omnibus pension bill currently that reflected the best work that was available at that time. Further refinements have been produced, and they're contained in the document that's tabbed 1A. There are also some other amendments, technical or a modest modification in tab B. So if you'd like to roll to either of those.
Well, yeah, well, why don't we take care of it there? And the 1A, it's actually the 19A amendment, is it? Okay.
Yes, members. And
okay.
Mr. Burek is prepared
to
handle that.
Mr. Burek, could you discuss then the erroneous deduction overpayment recovery by PERA for first-class city teachers?
Members, this is the tab 1A. It's in your packets. The 19A amendment makes some revisions to the PERA's erroneous contribution provision that's currently in the omnibus bill. One of the changes that it makes is it waives a repayment of interest requirements if the interest amount is less than $10, at least in certain circumstances. The argument for that being that the amounts are so small it costs more to try to do it than that amount is worth. The amendment also adds an election for any governmental subdivision with employees who have invalid salary amounts that were detected and in process of correction on the day this legislation passes. The election for those government subdivisions is an election to it allows them to decide whether they want the approximate three-year statute of limitations to apply to adjustments that are already in progress or not. Should I move on to the 21A amendment?
Maybe you should describe what that does as well, too. So.
What the 21A amendment does, this one is for First Class City Teachers Retirement Fund. It revises the erroneous contribution provision that's currently in the omnibus bill for First Class City Teachers to create a provision that is essentially the same as the new para provision will be once all the changes are made. And basically what that process is that if there is erroneous employee contributions due to salary that is in excess of salary as defined in statutes, then an overpayment has occurred. So the amount of the employee overpayments must be returned with interest. The accompanying employer contributions are to be returned to the employer, but without interest. If benefits are currently being paid as a result of those erroneous contributions, those benefits have to be corrected. That can get a little complex because when an overpayment of a benefit occurs, we have to recapture that. On the other hand, it was due to overstated employee contributions, so there's a refund going out. So there's essentially some language which requires a netting of the two so that we wind up with the correct total amount. Mr. Chairman, I also understand that there's a need for a 20A amendment, which I understand Representative Murphy wants to pursue.
Okay.
The 20A amendment is an amendment that is similar to the...
We don't have that apparently, though. So why don't you pass it out so we can at least know what the issues we're talking about here. Go ahead.
And the 20A amendment is a somewhat different erroneous employee deduction provision that would apply to the City of Duluth and the Duluth Airport Authority if those governmental subdivisions so desire, because there's a local approval clause that starts on page 2, line 30 for those two. This differs slightly from the revised para erroneous employee contribution just discussed, in that my reading of this amendment, and this is something that I put together from someone else's language, so I'm not quite as familiar with it as I perhaps should be. It seems to differ from the other language by requiring that any past benefit overpayment will not be recaptured from the individual, but instead will be an obligation of the City of Duluth or the Duluth Airport Authority, and they will be responsible for repaying para for that. Mr. Chairman, that's all the comments I have at this point.
Murphy, did you have any comments about, because you are offering one amendment here.
Mr. Chair, for the situations that affect WLSSD, the City of Duluth, and the Duluth Airport Authority, I know that we need Amendment 19 and Amendment 20. And I assume from what Mr. Burek said, we need 21 also. And but there is someone here from Duluth,
sure,
that would...
Okay,
speak
we do,
to
yes.
Especially the 21.
Okay. Do we have any other questions, the commission members, before we take some testimony? Eric Simonson, and is there anybody else who's here who wants to speak on the Duluth erroneous deductions?
Mr. Mark Winston is new city administrator.
Please come on forward. Please identify yourself for the record.
I Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Winson. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the City of Duluth.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Eric Simonson, representative of the Firefighters Union in Duluth.
Okay. Who wants to go first?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Winson.
Thank you for the opportunity, members of the Commission, to speak with you about specifically Amendment 20. This amendment gives the City of Duluth and Duluth Airport Authority the option to look at a balance between the pain or stress put on our active employees and our retired employees. Under the current language that governs para on erroneous contributions or deductions, City of Duluth is able to get records back to 1997. And under that, the current language, what would occur is that all of our active employees would get their erroneously made deductions or contributions to para back with interest under the current law. On average, those would be about $900 a person. The retired employees would be required to have their benefits reduced to what should be their salary, their high salary under the law, and would need to pay back and make para whole for any over benefits they received less the amount of their erroneous deductions. We have seen evidence that for some of these employees, that reduction in benefits on a monthly basis is between $60 and $150 to $200 a month, with paybacks ranging from $5,000 to $15,000. The language under amendment, I believe it's 19, which is kind of called the statute of limitations amendment, if applied to the City of Duluth, would result in the active employees only getting their erroneous deductions back to 2006. They would average about $250. Retirees would see a more minimal reduction of their monthly benefits and a fairly minimal payback, if any, on the past overage of benefits. Under current law, the City of Duluth would receive a credit for future employer or payments on para in the range of about $1.3 to $1.4 million. Under the statute of limitations amendment, that would drop to about $300,000. What you see in 20 creates a balance that brings measure to both the actives and their concerns and the retirees and their ability to repay. And under 20, in our understanding, the active employees would receive all of their erroneous deductions made with interest back through 1997, which is as far back as our payroll records are accurate. The retirees would have their monthly benefit reduced going forward based on the correct salary amounts. Their erroneously made deductions would end up being applied towards their overpaid benefits, and the City of Duluth's credit would be reduced to cover the rest of those overpaid benefits going back. In this case, the actives and the retirees essentially are made whole. The City of Duluth's credit going forward is still being calculated, but it's expected to be somewhere around $500,000 to $550,000. The Mayor of Duluth feels that this amendment gives the appropriate balance to the conditions that apply or are in place. All records that will be corrected going forward. Para is restored to the funds it has erroneously put forward due to the errors in our payroll system. That's it in essence. I'm open to any questions you might have. Or Mr. Simonson might want
Well, thank you, Mr. Winston. Mr. Simonson, is there anything you wish to provide?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make my comments very brief. I think Mark did a very good job explaining that, but I represent approximately 130 employees in the City of Duluth. I certainly don't represent the majority of the employees, but I think it's probably safe to say that the members that I do represent will probably be most affected by this particular issue. We are here today to speak in support of Amendment 20. We think that this is probably the most amicable solution available, given all the considerations. And I'm just happy to answer any questions that you might have on behalf of the employees that I represent. Thank you.
OK. Okay, are there any questions of these two witnesses? Ms. Vanek, did you want to provide any information? No, she does not. Okay. We do, Representative Murphy, apparently we do need to make a slight modification to the 20A amendment. At the bottom of page 2, we have two different effective dates with requiring local approval for two different entities. So Mr. Martin has suggested some language here just to clarify who's to approve what, because we can't have the City of Duluth giving approval for the Duluth Airport Authority. So, Mr. Martin, how would you suggest we deal with this?
Members, what I'm suggesting on page 2, line 30, after the word effective, to put in the words for the City of Duluth, and then on page 2, line 34, after effective, to put in the words for the Duluth Airport Authority.
So, Representative Murphy would incorporate those changes into the 20A amendment. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on the issues of erroneous deduction overpayment recovery provisions that we have before us? Okay, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I just have one question, Ms. Vanek, about just for to clarify my understanding. What about WLSSD?
And that,
is that later?
That stands for what?
Western Lake Superior Sanitary District.
I knew that, but I just wanted, okay. Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. The 19A amendment is the preferred amendment for Western Lake. I prefer that amendment because the solution that we have come up with for Duluth would actually cost Western Lake money. Their employer credit is less than what it would be for us to recover those overpaid benefits, so they'd have to put out money in addition to the credit, and that's why they prefer the statute of limitation over this other correction.
Representative Murphy.
That clarifies, Mr. Chair. Then I will move adoption of 19A, 20, and 20A and 21A.
Okay. We'll do these one at a time. Is there any discussion on the 19A amendment? Hearing none, Representative Murphy moves the 19A amendment. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Murphy moves the 20A amendment. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The 20A amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy moves the 21A amendment. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Okay, thank you. Now, we have some technical matters that need to be dealt with in the overall pension bill, and following the adoption of that, I will see if there's anybody who wants to offer any public testimony. We have heard all the issues that are in the omnibus bill so far, so we don't need to hear them all over again, but if there's anything that anybody needs to bring to our attention, we'll have an opportunity to do that. So I guess, Mr. Martin, do you have the technical correction and clarification amendments for the omnibus bill?
Yes, members, on tab B, there's a single one-page memo and then several amendments attached to that. The 11A amendment is simply a style and language usage using a consistent way of referring to PERA general plan, cleaning up some of the shall and may issues, that sort of thing.
Why don't we discuss that one out of the way now?
Does not change the intent of the bill.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves the 11A amendment. This is simply stylistic. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. The 11A amendment is adopted. Mr. Martin.
Members, the 12A handles an issue that was unresolved when the Commission heard Senate File 546, House File 726. This is the bill relating to the disability benefit coverage of the State Patrol and specifically their eligibility for the employer-paid medical insurance coverage. Mr. Bergstrom thought that there may need to be some additional language for covering the determination of disabilities in the State Patrol, some reference to the state retirement system. And after reviewing it, I believe he is correct. And so the 12A amendment adds language comparable to the references to the PERA executive director for the MSRS director. for purposes of determining disabilities and hence eligibility for state-paid health insurance for state patrol duty disabilitants.
Mr. Bergstrom, does this language work then? He's saying yes. Okay.
I move.
Representative Murphy moves adoption of 12A. Discussion on that motion. Anybody want to be heard on that amendment? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. A 12A amendment is adopted. Mr. Martin.
Members, the 13AA amendment attempts to clean up what I think were unintended portions of the teacher benefit increase provisions. There are two sections that were included in the bill that was rolled into the omnibus bill that would have the effect of sticking an applicability section or an applicability subdivision right in the middle of an existing statutory section, which is just at best confusing and could lead to inappropriate interpretations if the court tried to figure out why they were placed there. So that's more stylistic, but could have some application or some problems in the future. The balance of the amendment cleans up some vague language that in some readings could have constituted a 30 and out early normal our retirement age provision, which was not what the plans were providing. So the balance of the language clarifies that the age 62 for individuals with 30 years of service is the age from whence the early retirement reductions would be applied. And this is something that we've discussed with Luther Thompson and improves that portion of the bill.
Is TRA or anybody else had an opportunity to review the 13A amendment? Does it work? Mr. Thompson is nodding his head. Okay. Anybody else want to be heard on this amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of Amendment 13A.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves adoption of 13A amendment. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The 13A amendment is adopted. Mr. Martin.
Members, the 14AA amendment has to do with the proposed voluntary statewide lump sum volunteer fire plan. 14A tries to flesh out a portion of the of that proposed new chapter having to do with how the funding requirements of the plan would be calculated, specifically how the normal cost or the equivalent of normal cost would be calculated, and it makes it somewhat more analogous to the obvious model for the provision that's in the this article of the omnibus bill, the lump sum volunteer fire relief association guidelines act. I believe Ms. Vanek has seen these. I'm not sure what her reaction is to it.
Ms. Vanek, you seem okay with it. Okay. Anybody else want to be heard on the 14A amendment? Representative Murphy moves the 14A amendment. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. The 14A amendment is adapted. Mr. Martin.
Members, the 15A amendment has to do also with the statewide volunteer fire plan. It seemed to me that some volunteer fire accounts that would be in this new plan could narrowly get fully funded, and the current law provides for a credit that would occur if they are fully funded, and that if they're narrowly fully funded in 1 year, there could be a lot of yo-yoing back and forth. So a way to solve this is to require that they be fully funded for longer than 1 year. Hence, they would eventually get a credit, but they wouldn't get it right away. So this provides for a three-year, basically in the third year when you're overfunded, then you would start to get a credit. Your overfunding would be slightly larger, presumably. The difference between paying normal cost and an amortization contribution, then suddenly having that shut off and actually have a credit where you're paying less than normal cost can be fairly dramatic, and this would try and balance it out, something that I think might improve the provision. Again, I think Ms. Vanek has seen this, but I'm not sure what her reaction is to it.
Ms. Vanek, did you have anything on this?
Chair and members, I think it's a reasonable solution. The advisory group talked about this issue. We thought maybe we'd have time later on to come back and recommend something, but I think Mr. Martin's recommendation is workable, so we'd support that amendment.
Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the 15A amendment? Representative
Murphy. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of 15A.
Representative Murphy moves the 15A amendment. Discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The 15A amendment is adopted. Mr. Martin.
And the 16A amendment, which is the last one, cleans up a number of things that I've been accumulating in the last year of actual errors that were in past omnibus pension bills in the main. It cleans up a incorrect reference to PELRA. It also does away with a reference to the Minneapolis Teachers Plan, which was consolidated with TRA in 2006. It updates a service credit purchase for MRF. There was a rough analogous provision, rough equivalent to the general statutory provision for service credit purchases that's in Chapter 356 that had been plopped into MRF years ago. This gets rid of that individual MRF prior service credit purchase and uses the full actuarial value service credit purchase applicable at large. An incorrect our repealer from 1989 is cleaned up. An error that I made in 2008 having to do with some of the special loss citations for some obsolete volunteer fire provisions are cleaned up. And then an obsolete provision relating to the commission billing for actuarial services that is no longer applicable because the commission does not retain a consulting actuary funded in that manner. It's no longer needed, and it was not sunsetted on its face.
Does anybody want to be heard on the 16A amendment? I can't imagine why, but maybe somebody would. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of
16A.
Amendment 16A.
Representative Murphy moves the 16A amendment. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails. Ms. Martin, do you have anything further that we need to look at for technical amendments?
Mr. Chair, members, no. This would put the omnibus pension bill into form as we see it.
Okay. Before we move on to those other two issues, as I say, I've got one person who wanted to testify on the omnibus bill, and if anybody else wants to testify about anything, not repeating testimony we've already heard. But before we do, I do want to clarify one issue, and I may need to have either TRA or staff or whatever clarify the issue on the TRA reform bill. Just to clarify, there's going to be employer contributions and employee contributions and cost to the state, not in this biennium but down the road. So could we just clarify what that is, because there appears to be some confusion I've encountered in the last week or so from just making sure the members understand what particularly the cost to the state. I think we've heard the testimony that the employees realize they're going to have to pay more. The employers would like levy authority. That's beyond the ability of this commission to grant that, but we'll have to go to the tax committees. And the state contributions, what do those numbers amount to? And could somebody, Ms. Hocking, are you prepared to just quickly review, to refresh the commission's memory on just what those numbers actually are?
Members, while she's coming up to the table, I think page 86 and 87 of the omnibus pension bill is really what you're concerned about. Section 1 of Article 6 is the potential state tails. This is an increase in the state education aid starting in
2012
that offsets the cost of the employer contributions provided for in the balance of Article 6.
Okay. Ms. Hocking, could you again just refresh us as to what the state's contribution would be over and above the employer and employee contributions as you see it right now?
Mr. Chair, Laurie Hacking with TRA. As Mr. Martin explained, the bill provides for state school aid increases equal to the amount of the increased costs that employers would bear by virtue of the increase in TRA's contribution rates. There is no cost in 2010-2011. This doesn't kick in until fiscal 2012. And under using an aggressive payroll growth assumption of 4.5% per year, the first year cost would be $21.9 million just for TRA. I'd like to point out, again, that's using our actuarial assumption that payroll will grow by 4.5% per year. In reality, we have only been seeing about 3% per year payroll growth, and with the potential for salary freezes that are, you know, being suggested or some reductions, that's likely to be lower in the future, but we don't really know. If we assumed a 1.5% payroll growth, that instead of it being $21.9 million, it would be $20.1 million. So that gives you a sense of the potential range. So that would be in 2012. In 2013, it would be $45.9 and could be as low as $40.8 using the lower 1.5% assumption.
Okay, and then do you have an estimate as the out years after that, if 14 and 15?
Yes, 2014 is 71.9. Again, could be as low as 61.2 using the lower growth assumption. And the 2015 would be 100.2. And using the 1.1% growth assumption, it would be 82.9.
Increase so much.
And our understanding is that the annual, currently the annual school aid appropriation is $7.636 billion. So this would be significant, but still a relatively small percentage of that larger appropriation.
And these issues that have to be reviewed by the Senate Finance Committee, the House Finance and Ways and Means Committee, and so forth, to determine if that's, you know, because it's a commitment in future to the state's contribution. Okay. Does everybody clearly understand that issue? That Sarah Lynch.
So, Mr. Chair, is it your intention to include this provision in the omnibus bill?
Sarah Lynch, it's there now. Obviously, I wanted to call it to the Commission's attention in case there's any concerns. Obviously, this is going to have to go to, as they say, the budget areas to see what the budget divisions and the Finance Committees and the House Ways and Means Committee wish to do with that. But I want to make sure that, you know, the Pension Commission members understand what the proposal is that is in the bill right now. Sarah Lynch.
Mr. Chair, I would think that we might want to think about having this particular provision travel separately from the omnibus pension bill. That's a pretty...
It's possible to have the bill go separately. One way or the other, it doesn't, as I said, indicated last time, it doesn't matter to me whether I carry two bills for one bill. I still got to make all the same stops. Sarah Pappas, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, could you remind me, where is this money coming from? Now, there was an increase to the teachers, increase to the school district. Is this then the state's share?
Mm-hmm. How much is the state's share? I mean, because it is going to be, the employees are going to pay part of their share. The employers are going to pay it. I mean, I think that there's some hope that we will increase state aids to help them out. If no state aid is forthcoming, they're certainly looking for levy authority for the employers to do it. But, you know, none of us can commit to what the budget and finance committees are going to be doing down the road. So, but the plan right now is this is be an increase in state aid. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Martin?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Okay. Members, this money, the numbers that Ms. Hacking gave you for TRA, which would be slightly larger because St. Paul and Duluth would also be added in,
right.
Offset. They equate the amount of the employer contribution provided for in Article 6. So this is, to the extent that there would be any difference, the numbers, the aid only is based on a fiscal year 2012 salary level and does not go up after 2012. So it's to the extent that there is in salary inflation after fiscal year 2012, that would be borne by the school districts from revenue sources other than this state aid. But this does capture the fiscal year 2012 level of funding needed and phased in over 4 years.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to make sure it's clear, the numbers that we were just given beginning in 2012 through 2015, that's not the total increase in contribution. That's what the state's share would be during those years. And would that be meant, or am I misunderstanding that?
Mr. Martin.
Members, the figures that Ms. Hacking gave you are the TRA portion of the numbers. That TRA covers the largest number of teachers. St. Paul Teachers has a modest payroll. Duluth Teachers has a modest.
But just forget that aside.
Mr. Chairman, I'm really trying to understand, though, are there three parties that are paying into this or two? Is it the teachers, the school districts, right, and the state? What does this represent?
Let's accept the fact that St. Paul and Duluth are not here, but let's just talk about the numbers that we have before us right now. How much of these numbers are state contributions, how much of it is employer, how much is employee contributions? Is it all factored into one, or is it broken down separately? Is that's the question?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
The state aid reimburses, as it were, or provides equivalent funding to the employer's funding requirement. So the employer, the school district contribution is paid for by the state in Section 1 of Article 6.
Now,
so it's not three parties that are paying. The state is increasing the aid for school districts who then have to pay to TRA the contribution.
Now, would
the
that,
members yeah, would be making also the identical amount of contributions. They're also being phased in a 0.5% per year increase. So the total membership is also paying the same number of dollars.
Ms. Martin, be clear. Let's say $21.9 million. Who the state is paying that amount of money, supposedly, in 2012 to the school district, and the teachers are paying a matching amount.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sarah Lynch.
And, Mr. Chair, I don't know that we have it in front of us, but in the memo that we had on this bill, it did a good job of delineating that, I think. So that might be, if we had that to reference, that might be.
Remembers.
That might be good.
You want it? Is it available? We can get that. Well, but if you want, we'd like to have it for before we adjourn. We can have that.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that, as I recall, it pretty clearly delineated,
yes,
and so that just might be helpful for everyone present, so that it is very clear. We're talking about, you know, arguably a significant amount of money that we are need to consider as we balance our budgets.
Representative Nelson. Well, a question. Would you like to have that memo retrieved for tonight, or we can have it. We can get it. Well, let's go get it.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll have it gotten. We'll get it for you.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have, and I guess I kind of want it on the record here, if we didn't do this enhanced benefit for the teachers, what would the numbers be, future obligation? Do we have that figured out? You know, would we still have the 21.9? Would we still have these obligations going forward, the increases in them to deal with the deficits that are in the fund and the like?
Is your question that if
how much would the state contribution
be? If the legislature does not want to make the commitment to the
yes,
future funds, I think it could still be done, I think, by levy authority. Is it, Mr. Martin? If we didn't,
I think Representative. But
what I'm asking is, if we don't do the enhanced rule of 90 or whatever we're calling this.
Members, I can get you part of the way there, and Ms. Hacking can probably fill in. What is being intended here is to correct the current deficiency in contributions to the current benefit level paid by TRA, and also to pay for a benefit increase. And I think, Representative Nelson, you're asking what if you
what would the number be without the
parts,
benefit increase, yes.
And Ms. Hacking, I think, can provide us, or Mr. Thompson can provide us, what the deficiency in TRA is currently and what that would look like as a state levy only.
And keep in mind, the reason why we have to look at this is because they've gone from, in 2002, 100% funding down to 80% in 2008. Yeah, and that's why we have to do something, Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, the current TRA deficiency is 3.3% of payroll, negative 3.3%. This proposal, and let me add to that, it's negative 3.3%. In addition, the proposal to remedy the benefit inequities would cost 1.9% of payroll.
That's the first number.
Employer contributions would be going up in stages by 2% of payroll, and the employee contributions would be going up by an identical 2% of payroll. So there is a possibility, a distinct possibility, that a deficiency would still remain after all of those increases, including the benefit improvement. If that were the case, there's an automatic stabilizer in the proposal to then increase contribution rates for both employees and employers to take care of any remaining deficiency. But we're talking about out in the year 2016, markets could rebound, could improve, and mitigate the need to have further increases. That right now, excuse me, is hard to predict. Hard to predict what the markets will do and what exactly the deficiency will be. But I guess I'd also underline that this money, we do need it. Even if markets do rebound, we know that we have somewhat of a deficiency. And those obligations are out there. The more we delay in getting contributions in, the more that deficiency will grow. So in our view, we do need these contribution increases, and that's why we have a phased approach. Try it for 4 years, make an assessment at the end of that 4 years whether we still need additional contribution rates or perhaps we don't. I would also, if I could just add one other point. It's been longstanding in TRA's history. When contribution rates have gone up or down on the employer side, generally school aid has been adjusted to help offset the costs when they have gone up, and also subsequently when those rates have come down, there have been school aid adjustments or savings because the employer's costs have gone down. So this what's proposed in the bill is, in a sense, a continuation of what has been many years of practice with the way TRA's financing has worked.
Mr. Chairman, do you have to go to the K-12 committee then?
I don't know. Representative Nelson, let's see.
I guess that I understand all what you're saying, but I guess the question I'm asking, you gave us numbers for 2012, 14, and 15 of 21.9, 61.2 to 71 million. 82.9 to 100 million. If we didn't put the enhanced benefit in, what would those deficit numbers, or dollar, not percentage, but dollar numbers be? And I'm asking this so that the people on the floor and the other people out that are saying that we're giving the teachers an enhanced benefit, and I'm trying to dissuade that argument, but that people are giving the teachers an enhanced benefit, and the state's paying for it, and nobody else is getting this. And so what would these figures be? I know there's a deficit. What would these dollar figures be in 2012, 2014, and 2015 if we didn't put the enhanced benefit in there?
Do we know that?
Do we know that figure?
To answer that question, the enhanced benefit is, in a sense, being covered by the employee's increased contribution. The enhanced benefit cost is 1.9% of payroll, and the employees' contributions are going up by 2%, so with a slight margin to cover those costs in total. So I don't know if that answers your question. I'm sorry. I'm not sure how to and the numbers I was reading off is really coming from the employers to address the deficiency.
Okay. Sir Pappas, I just asked a question about who would need to see the bill. First, the policy committees in the House and the Senate have to take a look at it. In the Senate, the pension bill is scheduled for a hearing on April 6th. I'm not quite sure when the House is going to see theirs in the policy committee. It would ultimately have to go to, in the Senate, it would go to the Finance Committee, but once it's in the Finance Committee, it can move around within Budget Division. So if the E-12 Budget Division needs to see it, they can see it. The State Government Budget Division, which Representative Kahn chairs in the House, I chair in the Senate, we'd look at it because it does affect pension funds. I'm sure that I believe the House has a similar process to go. And ultimately, if we're talking about levy authority, it would have to go to the tax committees in the House and the Senate. So, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, so you anticipate that some of the state aid portion could be covered by levy authority instead of direct state aid payments?
That's a possibility, and I guess those are issues that have to be resolved in the finance and tax committees in both bodies. Yes.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Hacking, could you explain to me, I'm new to the commission, as we all know, why the dollars increase every year?
Ms. Hacking.
It's because there's an additional 0.5% of payroll increase in each year.
On top of
that's
the
right
last.
Until 2015 snowballs. When it would be phased 2%. Up to the full 2%.
I got it. Okay.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hacking. I was trying to follow your description of kind of the relationship or the interrelationship between the teachers' contributions and what the school district might pay and what the state might pay. But I really feel like we went around in a circle without really getting an answer to Representative Nelson's question. I mean, I think what you were saying is, well, the teachers are going to pay for this or a portion of this, and then the employers are going to contribute because that's what they do when the teachers increase their contribution, and then you normally as a state will reimburse the school districts for what they're paying. But that kind of all begs the question that Ms. Representative Nelson was asking, which is there is going to be an increased cost, and we're trying to figure out how much it is for this enhancement. I can't imagine that anyone in any of the finance divisions are going to not want to get to the bottom of the answer to that question, because we do have to balance. We just passed a law. We do have to balance the budget now for 4 years, and we're talking about, you know, a $67 million increase to the deficit that we have, which means an additional $67 million worth of cuts we'd have to do somewhere else. I just think we have to have an honest discussion about that, and we can't have an honest discussion about it unless we get to the bottom of the answer to Representative Nelson's question. So I think you need to be prepared to give that information.
Mr. Chair and members of the commission, I apologize for not being clear. The numbers, maybe I'll try to say it this way. The numbers that I gave you, the 20.9, all those numbers that you wrote down, employees, the teachers, will be paying identical amounts, increased amounts, just those same amounts, and those will be sufficient to pay for the benefit increase that's in the bill. So, in other words, employee contribution rates and employer rates are going up in tandem. They're going up identical amounts. The numbers I read you were the amounts that are going up for the employer, because that's the part that the state is hopefully would reimburse them through school aid or through a levy authority. But the employee side's going up at the same pace, the same amounts. And it's that revenue stream from the employee side that is projected to cover the costs of the benefit improvement. Does that
well, putting
help?
It in a simple way, when I go when I go to the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, I have to say, be prepared to book a certain amount of money for 2012 and a certain amount of money for 2013, a certain and yeah, he technically we don't have to talk beyond that, but you know, it's we know that there's numbers coming. So are these the numbers that you gave me? Would I have to tell the chair, okay, plan on booking those numbers as part of our budget process? Plan on spending $21.9 million in 2012. It might vary, and it's actually going to be a little higher because we've got two other funds right. that we haven't accounted. But as a base, you plan on in 2012, you know, adding 21.9 or more, and in 2013, plan on spending $4.5 million
45.
Or 45 or more. So I got to tell them put that on your ledger. Okay, gotcha. Okay, Representative Nelson.
So what you're saying, I guess then, if I'm hearing, that if we didn't do the teacher, the enhanced benefit, that we would still be having the employer contributions of this amount or similar amount to make up for the deficit, and the teacher contribution wouldn't be going up. Would that be fair to say if we did not do the enhanced benefit?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's a much much more straightforward way of saying it. Thank
you. Well, that's what I was trying to get at. So that,
the teachers are paying for their benefit increase, but they're also actually helping resolve the problem of TRA's deficiency because of the 80% funding problem. Okay, Sarah Olson.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, just so I completely understand this, then, if we weren't doing the enhanced benefit, would it be normally the case that just the employer would be making up for that deficiency? Or would that normally be a shared responsibility between the employee and the employer?
I see some heads nodding. Ms. Hacking, do you want to take a run at it?
Mr. Chair, in past years, that is how it has worked. That is, the deficiency has been more the employer's responsibility. And it could be a shared responsibility. That's why in this bill, in the out year after 2016, if there is a remaining deficiency, then that is a shared responsibility between employee and employer. And that's under that automatic stabilizer that I was explaining, that after the fourth year, if there is still a deficiency, then employer and employee rates would go up equally, and it would be a shared responsibility.
Now, it seems to me that the options,
that's in the out year.
It seems to me the options are, though, that if for whatever reason the fiscal people around here are saying we're just not going to make that kind of a commitment, we, you know, number one, just say local school boards eat the cost. And I can't think of any school board in the state that's going to want to do that because they're strapped. Number two, we just say, well, okay, we'll just let you levy it on the property taxes, which means property taxes are going to go up even higher, which is not a pleasant thought either. So there aren't any easy ones here for the whole thing. We're now passing out. This is the summary of the bill, so you've got it before you here. So. Okay, we have other questions here?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Yeah, I was just asking Mr. Burek, on page 87, on line 8711 and 8712, it's confusing that it says fiscal year 2015 and each fiscal year thereafter. It kind of sounds like it's going to continue 0.5% into infinity, each adding another 5%, another 5%, so going from 2% to 2.5 to 3 to 3.5. I don't think that was the intention, but it sounds like that.
It sounds like they'd be well overfunded if we did that. Mr. Martin, Mr. Burek, what was that mean? If each fiscal year thereafter? We don't know. Okay, well, that's not your bill anyway. Okay. Who can address that? Ms. Hacking, do you understand the issue? Is it a perpetual increase, I guess, is the question. I mean, are we...
It was intended.
Yeah.
No, what that means is that will be the additional rate in that year, the added rate of 0.5 in that year, and and years thereafter. So it doesn't go up an additional 0.5. It stays at that level. I believe that's what it's meant to say.
It's not what it reads.
Okay, so that's the – okay, it increases each one of those years and stops at 15 and levels off at that point. That's what the intent of that is.
Right.
Okay, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, and thank you to staff for bringing the memo, but on the memo on page 4, it was just distributed. On page 4, number 3, it's titled Affordability of the State Education Aid Increase Associated with the Proposed Employer Contribution Increase. I think this is a good reference, and the last sentence there talks about if the retirement plan has a contribution deficiency after 2014, it would not be accompanied by any additional state aid. So I think that's one thing to note. And then about midway in that particular paragraph, it delineates what those actual dollar amounts are for the state. And I would think, Mr. Chair, that those would be the figures that you would be approaching our finance division chairs regarding.
Well, hopefully we'll have the more accurate numbers, you know, as we get closer to those hearings, which is going to be fairly soon. So, yes, you're correct.
Mr. Chair, just to, I think what's on page 3 would incorporate St. Paul and Duluth numbers. So that's why they're, excuse me, slightly higher than the TRA numbers that I gave.
Yeah. Representative Nelson?
To the point about the, on 87.11 and 12, would it eliminate the confusion if we took out the, and each fiscal year thereafter? I guess I'm asking staff that because I also read that as if every year after that we're going to keep going up 0.5% in contributions. And
well, you may have a point. I mean, the line 87.5 says an increase equal to the specified percentage. So an increase means an increase, and so I'm not quite sure if you know how this would be read. We may have to think about, you know, a way to just clarify just what the intent is here. So, Senator Rosen.
I was just wondering if we could bring up the directors from ERA and MSRS, the directors, and ask them about their recent employer and employee contributions and how that's worked.
Okay. We've had a request for PERA and MSRS for your recent contribution increases. Yeah, when you say how it worked, you mean, you know, what the mechanics of how it works? Or is
historically what they've given.
Is it? Okay. Could you just discuss what you've done, Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System. In 2006, we passed a contribution rate without a benefit improvement for both employees and employers. And we phased them in over 4 years. So the employee in 07 went up a quarter, and the employer went up a quarter. In 08, another quarter, up sort of for a full percent. So our employee and employer contributions both went up to pay off the deficit.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA. Hera went through this a couple of times. In 2001, both our member and employer contribution rates went up by 0.35% each. And then in 2005, we had a phased increase, 3 years for employees and over 5 years for employers. And both times contributions were increased was specifically because of our funding situation. There were no benefit enhancements. So between 2001 and January 1st of this coming year, the employer rate has increased from 5.18% to 7%, and the employee rate increased for, I believe it was 4.75% to 6%.
That's your question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So a lot less than the 0.5% this bill is asking for.
Sure.
And Mr. Chair, too, I...
Senator Wilson.
With the contribution from the teachers, is that, and in the past, does that have to be,
Has there always been a salary increase to offset their contribution into the fund? I mean, is there an automatic salary increase that's got to be given from the school districts to offset that?
I think that'd be a collective bargaining issue, but I don't know. I don't know if Ms. Alzweiger wants to address that. If the employees are paying more, I mean, that's not funded here by the state dollars, but Ms. Alzweiger, how do your members see this coming down the road?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alzweiger, Education Minnesota, there is no correlation between those. In other words, when there is a contribution increase for the teachers, they end up paying for that on their own.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Alzweiger, so historically in the past, when there has been an increase, there has not been a collective bargaining increase to cover those pension requirements.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I believe that the any kind of increase that they got in salaries was totally independent of any kind of contribution increase that they received, or excuse me, any kind of contribution increase that they had to pay. And I would say historically, when we have received a pension benefit increase, that half of the increase has, if we get a pension benefit, that half of the contribution has been paid for by the state and half has been paid for by the employee. This varies greatly in that the teachers are paying 100% of the benefit increase, or the benefit improvement, I'm sorry, I'm confusing the two terms. So whereas before, in a recent pension benefit improvement, there were other, the state paid for part of it. And that's always been one of Education Minnesota's principles, that the cost should be borne equally by the employer and the employee, and we are willing as to try to fix this whole scenario, to step up to the plate, be part of the solution, and to pay 100% of the contributions needed for this pension benefit increase. And we are paying for part of the deficiency as well.
Okay. Any other questions? Members, I'm just thinking on page 87, if we were to strike on 8711 and 8712, just strike and each fiscal year thereafter, I think that would accomplish what we're doing here, because the paragraph starts out that there was going to be an increase in the following years. And so if it's increasing those years, I don't think we need the increase after that. I mean, the money's still going to be paid. I mean, you've ramped it up. But you don't need – but the language saying it would be an increase in each fiscal year thereafter, and that wasn't the intent as I understand it. You're gonna stop the increases at 2015 and just hold
– at 2%.
The 2% that you've gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Hacking, do you follow what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair – the section you're referring to has to do with the aid adjustment, not okay. Not the contribution increases. So you recognize that, right?
Right. But do we need the language on 8711 and 8712 in each fiscal year thereafter? Are those words needed?
You know, I'm not sure. We relied on those who are familiar with the aid sections to draft this, so I just am not sure I'd have to.
We'll tell you what, this bill is going to make a number of stops along the way. Mr. Thompson, can you advise us?
Well, I think you're correct.
Identify yourself for the record. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Luther Thompson, okay. TRA. I think you're correct that language, the way it does read, it is confusing, is that there are no increases thereafter, but before it is heard again, I mean, we would certainly clarify that and make sure with commission staff that it clearly states what the intent is.
Okay. Well, after the bill leaves here, there's other people working on it, not just pension commission staff, so we have to make sure that everybody fully understands what we're doing here. So So is there a suggestion that maybe we delete that phrase?
Mr. Chairman, would you like to delete it?
Yeah, I think for right now, for our purposes, it would make sense if we just
I'd like to move that.
I'll move to strike the
language.
Okay,
Senator Pappas moves it on page 87, lines 11 and 12, the words, "and each fiscal year thereafter," be deleted. Okay, discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Okay, members, any other discussion or questions on that? There is somebody here who I believe wants to testify, probably, I will guess, on this very issue. Anything else? Are we fully informed? Because I want to make sure the Pension Commission members understand this issue. It's going to be difficult enough for non-Pension Commission legislators to understand this. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, I think we're fully informed. I'm looking to you for some is the decision being made as to whether or not this is going to be included or travel separately? Is that a decision that the commission is going to be entertaining
tonight?
Can I make a motion that we take this out of the omnibus pension
sure.
bill and have it travel separately?
That motion would be in order. Why don't we finish the discussion on this overall topic? And you can make it either when we're done talking about the omnibus bill. There's two other items we have to include in the omnibus bill. So we've got a little bit of business to go, but you can make that motion. Certainly it would be in order. Any other discussion from commission members on this? I do have one person, Mark Haveman, who signed up and wanted to testify. welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. The Minnesota Taxpayers Association advocates for greater transparency in this very complex area of government finance, along with lower levels of taxpayer risk. Making defined benefit plans work for all stakeholders, active employees, retirees, and taxpayers, requires transparent, careful, and judicious decision-making with respect to both the promises being made and the means to pay for them. My purpose in testifying is to oppose the teacher retirement provisions contained in Article 6 of the Omnibus Pension Bill. We feel the teacher retirement provisions fail the tests of good public policy for several reasons. First, scheduled contribution increases are inadequate to pay for the restoration of fund health and the benefits increase. The actuarial work indicates that a contribution deficiency of 1.2% remains after the scheduled contribution increases, an issue which has been flagged by LCPR staff in their memo regarding how this proposal conforms to commission principles. Second, the condition of TRA has deteriorated since the date of the last actuarial report, making this an inopportune time to be considering benefit increases. Pension expert Gerard Miller of Governing Magazine estimates that a fund reporting an 85% funding ratio before the market collapse likely means that the real-time funded ratio has declined to a level closer to 60% today. Actuarial smoothing, he notes, will postpone the bill, but if it's translated into payroll terms, Miller estimates contribution hikes of 3 to 5% of total payroll will be necessary for funds to stay even. So in other words, we may find that this full slate of scheduled increases and perhaps more will be necessary just to pay current benefit levels. Third, we believe that this idea that employees are paying for their own benefit increases is simply not correct for this reason. Pension fund contributions are fungible. The State Board of Investment does not segregate money coming from employees versus that coming from employers, or direct money toward an existing benefit fund and a benefit increase fund. Because of this, the accurate way to describe this provision is that state taxpayers and public employees, teachers, are sharing equally in an insufficient attempt to fund existing and new benefit levels. The legitimacy of this pay for their own benefits argument can only be tested in the future when TRA has a financial condition meriting cuts in contribution rates. At such a time, under this idea, we would fully expect to see employee contribution rates remain constant and state aids or employer contributions cut. However, Article 6 states that upon a return to sufficiency, both employee and employer contribution rates must be decreased. Fourth, we question the rationale for justifying the multiplier increase for teachers. The December 2008 report from the three major state retirement systems concluded that current Minnesota plans, combined with Social Security benefits and modest levels of personal savings, provide a satisfactory level of economic resources for public employees who retire at a normal retirement age of 65 or 66. The benchmark for adequacy should be based on standards of replacement income, not the success of lobbying efforts elsewhere in this country. Fifth, we are concerned about accountability issues stemming from the use of new state aid. The projected $235 million in state aid, which was based on the memo provided several weeks ago, would crowd out other state general fund spending, including education spending. State aids reduce the transparency of pension spending and mask the potential long-term implications on school operating budgets. As this commission has made very clear, if state aids prove insufficient and additional contributions are still needed after the phase-in period, either school budgets will be squeezed or local taxpayers will have to pick up the tab. Sixth, we are concerned about the two-year delay to address fund health. Prudent funding practice might suggest that contribution increases to return to full funding should be made now to take advantage of depressed investment markets. We believe any discussion of benefit increases should be postponed until the 2011 legislative session, when the economic uncertainty may have passed and we have a much better understanding of where we are and what we can afford. Finally, we are concerned about the inequity issues created among all types of public employees and the lobbying pressures that will result. The difference between a 2.1% multiplier and the 1.7% multiplier applicable to the general plans for MSRS and PIRA is significant. It is a certainty that correcting this favorable treatment will become a major issue before this commission in the future. In conclusion, we live in an era of major budget deficits, an economy in intensive care, basic government services, including education delivery under significant duress, foreboding demographic trends, and existing unfunded liabilities for retiree health care and pensions. In these circumstances, fixing the existing problem and ensuring the problem doesn't get worse should be the sole focus for action. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Haveman. I think we would agree that, you know, we do need to fix the TRA's deficiency problem. It seems to me there's four sources that you can look at. You can look at a state appropriation. We have a standing state appropriation for it. I mean, that could be changed. The stock market performance for their investments, employer contributions, and employee contributions. So given those four sources, how would we put TRA back on a stable funding? We did merge the post and active funds this past year, so I don't know what our options would be then. Does your taxpayer association have any suggestions as to how we can address this deficiency?
Mr. Chairman, members, the standard way seems to be the most appropriate, that we identify what that unfunded liability is, translate that into a contribution deficiency, and split it between the employees and the employers.
Okay. So the employers are the school districts. Are you suggesting that we just tell the school districts to find their own contributions and find the money and pay for it? I mean, they don't have any levying authority right now. We'd have to give it to them. You know, I mean, that's a possibility. So are they supposed to just pull it out of their budgets for the employer contributions? Where do they get the money?
Mr. Chairman, this is a cost of providing an education okay. in the state of Minnesota.
So the school district should find the money out of their budgets. And the employees, you're suggesting they pay more to get the same benefits that they're currently getting. That, I just want to make sure I understand your proposal.
I need to understand that last part again. I'm sorry.
The employees pay more to get the very same benefits that they're currently getting.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
I see. Okay. I understand your position. Okay. Any questions of this witness from anybody? Thank you, sir. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on this issue? TRA, okay, Ms. Allswiger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota, and when I testified earlier, I was answering the other questions, so I thought I would just give a brief overview. You know, one of the reasons that Education Minnesota is supporting this bill is because, well, I guess there's two reasons. Number one, we need financial stability in the TRA fund. And two, we have an inequity of benefits in the teachers who were hired before and after 1989. And Education Minnesota has been here in the past asking for the rule of 90. Well, we decided it probably wasn't the best thing to do anymore. We decided to take a realistic approach, and as I stated before, we decided that we should be part of the solution and not ask for a combined age and years of service to have a rule of, such as 90. And that this, the provision that we have worked with TRA and others on, is one we think that is more fair to all parties, and that they would be paid for the years of service and the years of contribution. And, you know, as you know, last year when the merger of the POST and the Active Fund was put into place, we were concerned about that. And we did not support that. However, we are still stepping to the plate and saying we want this fund to be stable. And so we are paying 100% of the benefit increase. We are paying some of the deficiency. And historically, as you have heard from Ms. Hacking and others, that if there is a deficiency in the fund, that has been paid for by the state. And there are certainly a number of graphs that can illustrate that. Again, we are paying for all of the benefit and part of the deficiency. You have probably heard me, though some of the Pension Commission members who are newer haven't heard this, but when you compare Minnesota teachers to the other total 34 states that are coordinated with Social Security, because those are the only states that are comparable, we rank near the bottom in every single one of the component categories except for employee contributions. Ours are higher than most. So when you hear us saying that we're willing to pay for the employee benefit increase, I think that's a huge step. Again, I just want to say that we are part of the solution to try to fix this. Your obligation will not go away. In fact, it will get worse. Had a number of years ago we passed the rule of 90, we would not be needing the dollars that we need today. And the more teachers that get, you know, are older, it just ends up costing more. We think that if you get in now when the market is low, it will be an advantage to the state. Your pension funds affect the bond rating. By fixing this problem now, you are probably fixing it at a lower cost than you have right now. We are in this problem together, and that's why we are here to try to help fix this problem.
Any questions? Okay, is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the TRA issue? Okay, and before we move on, Senator Lynch, you had indicated a desire to make a motion and have it go separately. Let me just make two comments, first of all. Because it is a procedural matter, it does not require a majority on each side. It just takes a simple majority of the full commission to decide that particular issue. Second, Representative Thiessen is the House author of the bill, so if it is separated, then he would, because this is introduced as a separate bill. So I'm the Senate author. Doesn't matter to me. So he would be carrying the bill in the House as opposed to the omnibus bill, which Representative Murphy carries. Okay, so just so people understand some just side issues on that. Senator Lynch, did you want to discuss the motion?
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that Senate File 506, House File 592 be removed from the omnibus pension bill and travel separately.
Okay, did you wish to discuss the motion?
No, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
I think it's straightforward enough. Is there a discussion on the motion? Okay. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
The chair is in doubt. Those in favor, please raise your hands. Well, put your hands down. Okay. Representative Murphy is just coming back in the room. The motion before us, well, okay, she's entitled to vote here. She's back in. The motion before us was to have the TRA bill travel separately, to be taken out of the omnibus bill. I mentioned that Representative Thiessen is the author of the House bill, so he would be the author of that bill if it separately. And it takes a simple majority, not one of each side. So those in favor of the motion to separate the bills up, please raise your hands. Okay, I see. 1, 2, 3, 4. Those opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The motion does not prevail. Okay, is there okay, there's no further discussion on that. We have two other items. And then, as I say, if there's anybody who wants to testify in the overall bill, they'll have that opportunity to do so. But we have number the other item on our agenda is Senate File 1878, House File 1983, Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association, a number of representatives on the Board of Trustees. Mr. Barrick.
Members, this is item number two on your agenda. What the bill does, and the bill is on the very last page of this particular packet, rather than specifying that there be 10 elected members to the Minneapolis Fire Relief Association Board, rather than stating that in statute, instead it would be specified in the association bylaws that there be a number of elected board members not to exceed 10. So there's basically this transfer from statutory authority to bylaw authority. Now, members, we were told that the bill was being requested because the association was concerned about replacing board members and whether it was cost-effective to do that. This is a closed organization. The members and the board members are getting fairly elderly. They have had a few board members who have had some serious illnesses, and this question has arisen as to whether if a board member can no longer continue, do they have to replace that board member before the next election, or don't they? And they have argued that they could save a few thousand dollars by not replacing the board member. So that apparently is the intention behind this drafting. But if you look at the drafting, it really doesn't address that issue. It simply says that the board will consist of a number of members as specified in the bylaws, not to exceed 10. And I would also note that if you look at the very last line of the bill, the existing law language, there's probably enough leeway in that existing law language to cover the situation that they're trying to address. So the bill may not be needed at all.
Okay. Well, before we get further into some of the options and so forth, I think Representative Kahn, you had an interest in this, and Mr. Rice.
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with the members of the board that would like to have the ability to have less than 10 members on it. I guess I don't see how it works unless we pass the bill.
Okay, Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Brian Rice, attorney for the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association. I think that Mr. Burek did state the issue well. There are 10 more members currently on the board as required by statute. We have, of those 10 members, 4 members are in their 80s. 2 are experiencing health problems. The board recently had a discussion on it and thought that this would be an opportune time for the association to consider reducing the number of its members, giving the age that the members are there. Once you recruit and elect a new board member, it makes it very difficult to change that. 2 members that are currently serving are probably would not run again, and we just think it's an opportunity to reduce the board. Each board member receives about a $3,000 stipend per year, and members can take they do education and a trip with a tuition and easily maybe be another couple thousand dollars. So for each member or each trustee that was removed, the board would save about $5,000. We think it makes some sense, and we think it's a good opportunity to do it. And Mr. Wally Shermer is here, the executive director, if he has any comments.
Mr. Rice, do you know who makes those appointments to the board right now?
In the case of a vacancy, Mr. Shermer?
Well, I mean, I'm saying if you've got a certain number on right now and they're appointed or however they get there and you reduce the number, are you saying that, you know, whose positions are you eliminating for appointing? I mean, are they all appointed from one authority or multiple authorities? I don't know that.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't understand the question. Each of these 10 members are elected by the other members of the association for definite terms under the bylaws.
Okay, so they all come from the membership, and the members elect all of them. So reducing the number doesn't take away anybody's appointment authority.
Correct.
I see. Mr. Shermer, did you wish to testify?
Chairman Betzel and commission members, our original intent in being able to change this particular section of the law was to allow us the flexibility should the opportunity arise where we can reduce the size of the pension board without throwing our members under the bus, if you will. We would do this by attrition, and as Mr. Rice stated already, some of our members are at that point where they probably wouldn't run again. If the board were to want to reduce the size in the future, they wouldn't be able to do that the way the law is written now. So what we were looking for was an opportunity to have the flexibility to do so. And that was the whole intent of this change.
And it's my understanding you've got somebody in the hospital or whatever, so if the law is not changed, you're going to wind up having to make appointments anyway here. And so that's the impetus behind it. Okay.
That, Mr. Chairman, you're correct.
Okay, so and you've had have you had a chance to look at Mr. Burek's memo here? And have you any thoughts on anything here?
Mr. Chairman, we have, and the association would not be interested in any of the potential amendments. This bill we thought was pretty simple and straightforward, and I think the amendments would lead the commission into a much different discussion.
Yeah. Mr. Beer, could you just review briefly, you know, what the suggestions you want to bring to our attention are?
Go over the amendments, Mr. Chairman?
If you will.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the amendments address the issues that I raised in the memo. Okay. And we can group the amendments. The 6A amendment through the 9A amendment are different ways of specifying whether or not a vacancy will be filled and how that vacancy would be filled. The 6A amendment would specify that if an elected member position is vacated within 1 year of the start of the next term, the Relief Association wouldn't have to fill that position. The 7A amendment is an alternative to that, and that says that if an elected member position is vacated within 1 year of the next election, the board could fill that vacant position by appointment. And if that position had been vacated by an active member, the new appointee would have to be an active member. If it's a retired member, it would have to be a retired member. Surviving spouse had to be a surviving spouse. The 8A amendment is similar to the 6A amendment, except it leaves the language, the existing law language in place, specifying that there would have to be 10 members on the board, and it would be specified in statute, except as otherwise required by these other amendments.
Sarah Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I thought they wanted to reduce the size of the board, and they wanted to do it as members leave the board.
That's my opinion.
And have a smaller board. So I don't understand why all these amendments don't seem to be relevant.
Representative Nelson.
I got a Mr. Chair, and for either Mr. Rice or Mr. Shermer, it talks about the bylaws here. In your bylaws now, how do you replace members if you lose a member, if a member dies or can no longer serve? How do you do that currently?
Mr. Shermer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we have bylaws in place that allow us, if we're close to the next election, we'll wait till the next election, and then we'll have an election to replace that spot. If it's a retired person, then it's replaced by a retired person. If it's an active person, it's an active person that replaces it.
Mr. Chairman, I think to that question, I think if the vacancy occurs within 6 months of the term, then we leave it vacant. Otherwise, we'd be required to fill it.
Representative Olson.
So, right, and I guess I got a couple questions here, and you can answer them at once. What is the length of the term that the members serve is the first question. The other one is here. By the amendment here, we're changing the number 10, specifying that there's 10 members to a number that will now be specified in your bylaws, so that you could lower that from 10 to 8 so that it would be a 10-member board by your bylaws, and you wouldn't have to come here to do that in the future. Is that what I'm reading this as?
Mr. Shermer, Mr.
Chairman Betzel, yeah. Representative Nelson, that's correct.
And as far as the length of your terms?
3 years.
3 years, okay.
Commission members, what do you want to do? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shermer, are there equal number of retired people and active people on the board?
Mr. Shermer.
Senator Betzel, Representative Murphy, no, there's 2 actives currently and 8 retired.
Okay.
Is that specified?
No.
Okay. Mm. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that this be included in the omnibus bill.
Representative Kahn moves that Senate File 1878, House File 1983 be included in the omnibus pension bill. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next item, Senate File 1625, House File 1923. This is actually a technical issue. Ms. Vanek, you may need to explain this one. I think you can do it better than Ms. Vanek.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PARA. Clearwater County Memorial Hospital sought legislation to be included in our privatization chapter a couple of years ago. They had actuarial work done in January of 2008 to determine the cost of that, and legislation last year gave them until January 1st, 2009 to actually privatize. They didn't get it done. They are in the process now of finalizing their paperwork to actually be sold and privatized, and so they've asked for an extension. When they discussed this with me, they asked if they would be required to spend another $7,500 for an actuarial study. We did a review of the data set. There were 158 employees involved in the first study, in the initial study. Of that 158, there are, well, not of that same group, there are now 103 employees. And of that 103, there are 37 people who have just been hired in the last year. So we feel fairly confident that an actuarial study at an additional cost of $7,500 is not necessary to go ahead and allow them to privatize yet this year. So they're asking for an extension to January 1st, 2010, just to be safe that they can get it done this year.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of 1625 and 1923.
Yeah, before I do that, Mr. Burek, you did have something prepared for us. Did you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, members, if the commission is comfortable that, in fact, the finding remains, that it remains valid that PARA will not have a loss as a result of this consolidation, as of this privatization, then you could just pass the bill as is.
Okay.
If you're not comfortable with that, then you could consider the 1A amendment, which would require an actuarial review.
And Ms. Vanek, you are comfortable with not having another actuarial study. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Any other questions? Okay, so Representative Murphy moves that Senate File 1625, House File 1923 be incorporated in the omnibus pension bill. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Is there anybody else who's here who wanted to testify on the omnibus pension bill as it has been assembled? As I say, I don't want to repeat testimony you've already heard on all these bills over the last month and a half or so. Is there anybody else who's here? Seeing none, then Representative Murphy moves that the document is prepared as amended. I guess it's what, 191-DES as amended, be adopted as the omnibus pension bill to be amended on the appropriate House and Senate pension files. I guess so. We're gonna amend the
amend them. 191.
It's Senate File 191. I don't know what the House number is.
723.
House File 723 on those respective bills. There's a discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Members, one or two other quick things here. We still haven't wrapped up the MRF issue. I'm waiting to hear from the City of Minneapolis. When we have some resolution from what the City of Minneapolis does, we will have another commission meeting. That bill will probably move separately. Hopefully it can catch up to the omnibus bill at some point, but I don't know when that's going to be. So plan on at least one more meeting. As I said, the Senate is going to be hearing the pension bill that we just adopted in GovOps on April 6th. I'm not sure Representative Murphy will have to work with the
Tuesday.
Okay. Next Tuesday, April 7th. Okay, so we'll meet the deadline. At some point, we will be coming forward with a list of the dates for the interim hearings. I'm thinking about once a month or so for a couple of hours. I'm interested, you know, hearing some feedback. I'm thinking like a Tuesday from, say, 10 until 2. Is that going to work for people? If not, just let me know. We'll look at the bills, the issues that we did not get at in the 09 session, and any new things that come up, you know, over the interim that people want us to look at, we'll have at least 2 weeks' notice before we, you know, actually meet. So the issues will be out there, and people will be prepared to talk about that stuff. So,
Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Kahn.
If you don't care, I'd prefer Wednesdays or Thursdays to
Tuesdays.
That's
fine. It doesn't matter to me.
Okay.
I mean, that's why I just threw it out there. I suspect the Mondays or Fridays are probably out.
Yes.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at Wednesdays or Thursdays are better, that's fine. That's why I just wanted to get the feedback from the members here.
Depending on what week it is, because
Well, I'm thinking we should try to find some common time, like maybe the second week of each month. Would a Wednesday sound best?
Well,
I mean, we'll look at the calendars and figure out what works.
I just
obviously
have a reason for not.
Okay, sure,
Tuesday,
I understand
so
that.
No
okay,
one else does.
But and for, especially for the members who come in from Greater Minnesota, is 10 until 2 a nice time frame for you?
If you provide lunch.
I'm fairly cheap. I'm cheap. Okay, Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chair, for me it's a little over a 4-hour drive, so
what time frame would you like?
11 to 3 even would be nicer.
11 to 3 is what you'd prefer? Okay.
On Monday? Are you talking about?
Well, we're
on
looking
Monday,
at
it doesn't matter.
I'm thinking of Wednesdays. 11 to 3. Is that what would work best for members?
Well, whatever.
Okay. Well, we'll come up with a calendar, and we'll show you the dates. And as I say, if there's particular dates, for instance, when there's legislative conferences or dates that we know aren't not going to work, we'll adjust them, you know, just to meet because, you know, we're not going to have meetings that I can't get quorums for. So anything else to come before us at this time? So, Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is an old issue, and I'd just like to pose it as a question,
mm-hmm.
not a motion.
I think I know it's coming.
I would like to know if there are three senators who would support increasing the size of the pension commission with the addition of one extra minority member.
So. I think we'll have to discuss that at a conference committee.
I don't want to the point is, I thought I could just ask if there were three senators who would discuss it and I wouldn't have to put it on the bill at some other point to discuss it. So that there's one. I've spoken to one senator who I know does support it. So and I spoke to another senator who does not support it.
And I
and
don't support it.
The chair does not support
so,
it. So I just want to know if there are two others who would support it.
Representative Kahn, I think you can talk offline on that one. And then obviously, when the bill's in the House, the House will do what it will do. Okay.
I just thought it might be a little easier if there.
Nothing's easy. Nothing in pensions
right,
is easy, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman,
I'll find out.
But I commend
offline.
You. I am. We know of your perseverance. Representative Smith.
Can the representative find three representatives to support?
I thought last time the House totally.
Sounds like a House issue to me. So. Right. Anything else to come before us? Well, thank you, members. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
I hate to.
Thank you. Good work.